Coffee Sketch Podcast is our take on the intersection of old tech and new tech, the space between the traditional practice of the hand-drawn sketch that has been performed by architects and designers for centuries, and the modern-day use of the hashtag as a representation of a sentiment or a movement. Each week we plan to deliver a new pod about our ideas, sketches, and what's going on in our daily lives as we pursue our love of architecture, design, and sharing this knowledge with the next generation. I'm Kurt, and I'm in Flint.
And I'm Jamie, and I'm in Austin.
Hey, Jamie. How's it going?
Hey, Kurt. Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Well, I am loving working from home.
Yeah.
I feel 1,000 times more productive. But with, obviously, it's not totally alone. I video chat with the staff every morning at 9. Mm-hmm. And we kind of talk about each person's day, what it's going to look like, and try and balance the workload. So we still have the video communication, I think, very helpful. And, you know, by our time tracking software, our productivity or billable time is gone up by percentage. So I think it's a good case for being productive.
Although, yeah, I did hear an interesting quote today, though. You're not working from home. You're at home during a crisis trying to work.
Oh, yeah. I think that...
Which I think is another interesting perspective on it, because I think there's, like you say, there's some natural efficiencies of, you know, kind of when you're in the groove and kind of able to get through tasks that you have on your list. Collaboration's a little different. I think that there's ways to do that, but it's a. But I think the sort of the existential aspects of everything is something that everybody's probably still dealing with.
Yeah. And I mean, I should say that I don't have any young children any children. And none of my...
You don't have the old children either?
Young nor old.
Young nor old.
And everyone I work with either has no children or all grown up children. So in that case, like my brother, not an architect, but everyone is at home, the daycare is shut down, and he's got a 10-month-old and a 3-year-old, and he's struggling.
Yeah, but he just throws on like the headphones and like and just makes beats. So
he does. I don't know. I think that happens after hours.
Oh, okay.
You're in it. I saw somebody's social media post a picture of headphones and a glass of wine, and it said, like, mommy's on a timeout. Like, you know, they're just, instead of putting kids in the timeout, it's like, no, I'm going to be on a timeout, put my headphones on and drink this wine, and, you know, everybody, you know, go about your business.
Noise canceling. Yeah.
I think it's kind of been fun to see people's coping mechanisms and ways to kind of break out of any funk and try and do, you know, something to keep from going cabin fever. Or,
well, I think that's an excellent point. And to break out of my funk, there's probably one thing that, you know, it's probably an easy one to guess is Jamie sketches more. So
we've seen some increased activity on
Jamie
Instagram.
Sketches a whole lot more when he's in a funk, because
that's
I've
good.
I've revealed that on the show before, is that it's a creativity tool, but it's also one where I've developed it as a technique to kind of refocus my thoughts, and definitely the sketching has increased over the last couple weeks here.
Oh, you know what we should do?
What's that?
We should, well, sorry, it just dawned on me for a second here. We should shout out someone on Twitter who's retweeted one of our recent podcasts, the one about the Pritzker Prize, Grafton Architects. I don't know if we already shouted this person out, but we should do it again. So, Michelle, if you're listening, I hope you are. Thank you for the retweets and the likes. And we're going to try and do more of that as we have found an audience, right? So, well, is that how this goes?
I think that's how the, you know, all the cool kids. I think how the cool kids do it. So, you know, we'll just leave it right there.
That's like the first time we've had a chance to speak to a listener.
No, you've talked to classmates before, and then I think your brother was like, when he got on with us in that, the one time we used alternate technology to record our podcast, he was like, yeah, long time listener, first time caller.
True. So, any progress on the coffee front? Anything new?
Actually,
and exciting?
Yeah. So I forgot I had bought this for myself, before I was, you know, doing the supply run. So I had this in the back. This was another one that I found in the back of the pantry. My pantry's not very big, but, somehow I found a way to hide some stuff for myself, which was kind of cool. So this was actually, it's actually even labeled limited edition. I don't know what that means. But it's a Starbucks limited edition. I think it called to me because it had caramel in the title. Yeah. So caramel cream or creme, if we want to play a little French. It's the caramel creme. And I have to say I hope it's not going to be limited. Cause it's pretty good.
Nice.
I've enjoyed it. It even has a little bit of vanilla in it. And you know, we've talked about my affinity for the vanilla, so, and the coffee.
Very, very nice. I am sticking to those porch pickup beans of espresso roast that are, you know, keeping me sane and stable through the at home during a crisis, trying to work. Mindset.
Precisely.
So you specifically wanted to talk about a couple of sketches.
Yeah.
And being that there is some recent, well, how do you put it? Not everything is relevant. Everything we talk about is relevant, but timely and relevant is what I mean. And so We have two sketches because they have a theme or a tie together.
Yeah, so it's sort of closing out the month of March, which we are with this last recording for the month. Kind of slipped in two sketches in the last week of March of two very, very different architects, but ones that I always sort of think of and are special to me for different reasons. And so this is Women's History Month. And so I wanted to talk about these two different architects and via these two sketches, which on Instagram, everyone seemed to really like. So that's, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So one, we're going to try and do both of these here is just talk about, the one is Julia Morgan's work at Hearst Castle
in San Simeon.
San Simeon, yeah. Which, you know, I've never made it to Hearst Castle when I lived in California. And it's up north, which is not a good excuse. But
I mean,
but I never, you know, I do regret. It's one of those places that I regret not realizing the significance on many different levels, right? And in time before we moved away from California in order to go take a visit. And Julia Morgan is an AI gold medal winner, right? I believe.
Yeah. 2014 gold medal.
Yeah, that's
she
right.
She was the first. Posthumous. Right. Yeah, posthumous and the first woman to ever receive it. And I, right. Not to say that she was not the first woman who ever should have deserved it. So she's the first woman to receive it in 2014. But I think maybe another interesting fact is that she's the first woman to have ever been licensed as an architect in the state of California.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And really like 100 years, a little over 100 years before she got the AIA gold medal. So that being said, clearly an oversight on somebody's part. but I think that, you know, if you have ever been to San Francisco, you've probably seen some of her work, and probably not even known that it was hers, but, Hearst Castle is just, an amazing treasure and well worth the visit. Highly recommend it. I actually had been planning a trip, and thought it might even be this coming summer, to take my daughter back out to California. I've never been out to California with her. And I lived in California when I was younger. And, one of the things I had mentioned before on the show was, well, somebody's invading that social distance of the house. So,
Tinkerbell, thank you for shouting out Julia Morgan.
She wanted to make sure we knew she's here too.
That's right.
But no, so what I was saying is, so, you know, when I did live in California, one of the things that we did do was went down and saw the missions. And as part of that trip, my mom also wanted to go see Hearst Castle. And again, you know, no architects in the family, didn't really, you know, it didn't kind of recognize the architect at the time, obviously, or even the significance of that. I do remember, you know, her being discussed, you know, in the tour and something that my mom mentioned. But then as I kind of went into architecture school and then, you know, started to look back at all these places that I'd been, even as a kid growing up, you know, this one really kind of stood out. And for everybody who's not sure who Hearst is, you know, think Citizen Kane, you know, medium magnet, you know, William Randolph Hearst. And so this was his private residence in California.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. The, newspapers, right? Or newspapers. All kinds of press. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, back in the heyday of paper, reading things on actual pieces of paper.
Exactly.
Yeah. But also, I remember we were in, at the convention when they gave the gold medal away, which is why it's still in my mind. So recently, And I do remember you reminded me of that fact of her becoming the state's first licensed architect. I think, you know, as a student in California, I remember that, you know, learning a little bit about Julia Morgan probably around in the same kind of period or breath of like Green and Green.
Right.
And that kind of movement, but I mean, I wouldn't say her work is pure arts and crafts, because I mean, her, you know, the what would you call it? Like, I don't know. I have trouble like citing these styles.
Well,
the
I mean,
style
I think,
of this.
Well, I think that I mean, I think that the beauty of it is that, you know, hers wasn't really, I mean, she studied at the École de Beaux-Arts. I mean, you know, so mm-hmm. she has a really kind of classical training. I think that pedigree of, you know, academia, I think really kind of served her well historically. So I think she kind of jumped between historical styles of that time period. And you have to remember a lot of kind of earliest 20th century work was where there was this grappling for kind of new historicism. So we were kind of going back into, you know, select periods, oftentimes regionally throughout the country. And, you know, so William Randolph Hearst's Hearst Castle, which she, I mean, she designed everything. I mean, you know, the main house, the guest house, all the pool pavilions, the pools. I think she, you know, picked light fixtures. You know, I'm not sure if she, you know, also, I think she sourced furnishings, you know, artwork. I mean, it was a really, you know, big A architect kind of opportunity. And I think it was all sort of related to her, you know, education and sort of passion for, you know, understanding, you know, the historical moment that, you know, this particular building was placed in, and then some of the other interests of her client. So this was more of the Mission Revival, or like a Spanish colonial is oftentimes, you know, referred to it as. You know, some people, you know, would, you know, pick up on like hacienda plans, you know, for aspects of this particular project. But her work in San Francisco and in Los Angeles and throughout the state of California, I think there's, you know, a neoclassicism, you know, to a lot of her work. And then at the same time, you know, there is a fair amount of arts and crafts detail that also shows up in some of her other projects. So I think, you know, it wasn't necessarily one building type or one set of materials either. And I think that that's sort of the, you know, the reason why you give somebody like that a gold medal.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, this stuff is amazing. I'm looking at images, just, you know, Google images, Julia Morgan, and, you know, you see the real picture of Jamie's sketch, which is spot on of the pool. And, you know, the more I look at this and some of the other projects, it's exactly right what you said, the arts and crafts, but neoclassical influences and things like, you know, the Beaux-Arts influences are in there. I mean, it says here, I mean, according to Wikipedia, that she designed over 700 buildings, which is, I mean, amazing. And considering what buildings she did design, so many public buildings, so many sort of mansions or estates.
Right.
So it's not just like, oh, 700 single family homes, you know, 1200 square foot homes, which, hey, wouldn't be a bad deal either. But
you this know, is where Kurt said, scale. I can take one of them.
Let me design the guest house, please. The pool house, the cabana. it reminds me of, I could see a lot of that arts and crafts influence in there. And, you know, being a Californian, not me, Julia, and settling back in the Bay Area. Which, you know, the turn of the century, you know, around that time when California had so much going on. I mean, it's kind of like the blank slate of the country, and people, once they discovered the pleasant weather that was out there, you know, they just, I think, flocked and grabbed land wherever they could just to be an inhabitant, a citizen of the California lifestyle. She has some work with the YWCA and other women's service buildings too, which is also very neat. And again, like the last thing is to reiterate what you said about 100 years. You know, is it kind of a long time to wait to get that gold medal that probably should have arrived a lot sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing too, is that, I mean, it's, you know, when you look at some of the, you know, the projects that are, you know, designated historical landmarks, like the Berkeley City Club, you know, or it's, the work is very, very significant, both culturally, historically, I think what you mentioned, you know, but I think, you know, architecturally, you know, the, you know, I've had this discussion sort of recently with folks about historical appropriation. And so, you know, in the work that I do, you know, there's, you know, sometimes a misnomer where people, you know, want to design something in a historical context that's all new construction, and that's fine, well and good, but you have to acknowledge the times in which you're actually doing the work. And I think that what was unique about the time in which she worked was that there was this acknowledgement of historical styles, and they were, you know, kind of codified in these, you know, romanticized revival. And I think, but the thing that, you know, makes those works still stand the test of time, even though that some of them are looking at kind of revivals of, you know, more classical periods, is that the detailing on them is incredible. You know, so in this sketch, you know, I really tried to capture, that, you know, that thing, which I think a lot of architects really, you know, strive to do is capture the spirit of a place. And I think that the Neptune pool at the Hearst Castle is that iconic image that a lot of folks really kind of, gravitate towards. And it's, again, you're looking at these classical elements as pool structures around this pool that's clearly new. And even the pool structures themselves are clearly of a current age. They're not, you know, we're not taking some Greek temple apart and bringing it over to, you know, California and rebuilding it. You know, this is all new construction. And I think it's done just really, really well. And the scale of it is incredible. And then the patterning inside the pool is amazing. And then when I went and studied in Europe, you go to a place like Tivoli or Villa Rotunda or the Villa Borghese, you know, and you see this relationship of building to landscape. And in Tivoli's case, you know, building to pools in the landscape, and you think, wow, you know, these kinds of projects really kind of synthesize all of those disciplines into one. And I think, you know, Julia Morgan's work here is really kind of indicative of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how big that whole property developed?
No, I wish I knew more. And that's the thing, is that, you know, wanting to go back there was, you know, as an architect now, and having traveled a little bit more with kind of an architect's eye, I think I could have really appreciate my mom taking me there, you know, when I was about 10 years old. And
right, yeah.
And she knew that, you know, that I loved art and I loved history, and you know, maybe in her heart of hearts she knew I'd be an architect one day. She's never told me that, but you know, I really, really loved that trip. And, you know, seeing all the missions in California, but, you know, Hearst Castle really stood out. And I think it's this kind of work that just really kind of, you know, jumps out at you. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really wanted to go back and kind of learn more about it, you know, kind of firsthand.
Yeah, you know, your sketch does capture the spirit. I give you thumbs up from over the airwaves.
Thank you.
In comparison to some of the photographs of that same space, yeah, the detail, the backdrop, the setting that it really creates, the articulation of the pediment, you know, the tops of the little pavilions that are surrounding the pool. Yeah, it's one of those things that, like you said, the landscape and the buildings, right? It's all one thing, and the whole thing, you know, to get that opportunity to do that once would be fantastic.
Right.
And in her case, you know, kind of over and over again. And it really marks a period of time in this country when there was, you know, for better or worse, you know, a very passionate interest in kind of staking the claim and sort of, how do you put it? Just kind of a territorial, like, here's my, you know, this is representation of my wealth, you know, and that, I'm not trying to downplay it or belittle
no,
it, but
no.
That was kind of how things grew in that sense, like around these hubs, right? These, I mean, let's go back in time 100 years and you think about, no internet and, you know, far less population and less sort of excursions, like no strip malls, no
fast strip malls. Food,
no fast food, no mall malls, mm-hmm. and no movie theaters. So one's home was kind of, they had to occupy themselves and entertain themselves within their own home, in much like how we are all trying to do right now.
Yeah.
In a way to compartmentalize or create little experiences within the boundary of your own property. So not really compartmentalize, but kind of create these little experiences within the inside your property. So yeah. That's what I see in the sketch, and
we have another sketch that we were going to use as sort of a counterpoint to this. And I think that in both of their cases, one of the things stylistically that I was trying to do, this is me being critical of the work afterwards, and realizing in the moment I was doing it deliberately, but didn't kind of catch myself until afterwards, was that again, these are still pretty quick sketches. So these are, both of these are 15 to 20 minutes. Even in that amount of time, you can't necessarily draw all the details. And I think what was intentional on my part was trying to kind of leave some of it up to your own imagination. And so there's aspects of the drawing, especially in the pool, where the foreground gets darker and it's really, has a little bit of that forced perspective again. But there's aspects of it that just start to almost pixelate in a sense. And that's intentional. Some of it's because I'm trying to, water is really hard to draw, as we've talked about before, but, I think part of that also was sort of intentionally trying to, you know, let the image stretch beyond the canvas of the small little sketchbook, at least in your mind, kind of mm-hmm. so that the viewer can kind of really enjoy it in that way. And then the second one is probably one of my favorite architects, and because of their influence and inspiration, at a point when I was, you know, studying architecture, was I did a little bit of the similar technique where it was kind of really focused on a small aspect of the building and letting kind of the image sort of explode off that page and kind of bound, you know, beyond the bounds of the sketchbook itself.
Mm-hmm. I think this is your favorite.
Yeah, she's my favorite. Yeah, she's my favorite. Yeah.
It's Zaha Hadid. And, and you know, in the comparison, real quick, though, what's cool about, I kind of talked all about everything around your sketch and kind of dabbled in it, but in the Julia Morgan and the Hearst sketch, you know, you're hinting at some reflection of the pavilions. And then you have a little bit of water, and then almost like, you know, you're trying to hint at a ripple in the water, but then also what's in the pool, the bottom of the pool, which is an ornate tile pattern. So then the water is kind of like an invisible sheet that you can't see, and it's just the bottom. So it's kind of a neat, it's very deep, three-dimensional. It's deep, man. It's deep.
Well, and what was interesting was it didn't have the same effect until I added the sky. The depth of the pool really didn't happen until I added the sky. So the sky got added literally last to the sketch, and you know, added a couple extra minutes to it. Just I really felt it needed it to kind of ground the back of the image and kind of get your eye moving up and down, which I think really adds to the whole depth. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you mentioned that.
The sky does really help kind of create the focal point, this sort of forced perspective, like you said. So then in comparison with the Zaha sketch, it's still like, so there's a lot of detail in Julia Morgan's architecture, and then there's a lot of detail, but about minimalism in Zaha's architecture.
Yes.
And the way you've rendered that sketch is, I'm going to say, it appears more delicate, but not, it's still a quick sketch, you know, so what you're in your style of preparing a quick coffee sketch, but it's got this fine grain texture to it that kind of complements the minimalist style of Zaha's building. You know, the way you've cross-hatched and hatched in such a fine line and then stippled in some panel creases and things like that to hint at the curvature of a Zaha building, right? You know, very.
And stippling, I have to say, is like probably my least favorite thing as an artistic technique ever invented. So those who do stipple drawings, shout out to you. I think those are amazing. I admire them and I love them. And when I try and do them, I'm like, why am I doing this? This is awful. This is painful.
Does this sound like?
Yes. This is like an old time radio show, kids.
One of my bosses is a hand drafter, although I've taught him a few computer tricks. But he would draw drawings.
Here is the on button.
And then he would sit there and start. You could hear him. You knew when he was. It was just that. And I'm just making a joke about stippling, but you know, I think it's a very interesting technique that I remember. Yeah, I don't know if I loved it or hated it, but it was kind of an interesting activity, especially when in design school, say second year, everyone's exploring various rendering techniques for their ink on Mylar.
Oh yeah.
And stippling becomes the one. I had a.
It had never a was the one. It was never the one for me. I'm sorry. It never was.
I'm glad that you're definitively certain of that.
I can do it. I know, you know, the concept, the principle. I've taught it, but you know. Man, it's painful. And apparently my coworker also does not like stippling at all. So
yeah. She does not allow it.
No.
So
Kurt, why'd you bring that up?
So remind me which project this one is actually, because I forget the name of it.
So the only tip off, the only clue that I left in the hashtags, because I sometimes leave clues in the hashtags, is Take Me Back to London. Also a very good lyric, Ed Sheeran. But the building is the Serpentine Gallery. There's the Serpentine Gallery, and then more affectionately, everyone sort of knows about the Serpentine Pavilions because they get so much more press. So the pavilions are the temporary thing that they do annually every year. but the gallery is a permanent building. And Zaha actually renovated the Serpentine Gallery and did an addition to it. And so what you're seeing here is where the addition comes over and sort of kisses the side of the original brick building. It's pretty great. I was in London 2 summers ago, and Em and I went there and saw Christo's work live and in person in Hyde Park, and also got to see the Serpentine Pavilion by Frida Escobedo, which was an amazing, amazing commission to see. But then we also got to see the gallery and the work by Zaha.
That's cool. I remember seeing that on the cover of Architecture Record, or I would imagine it's the Record, but it's a good representation of some of her most well-known or her architectural explorations that become reality. I think, I've seen only a couple of her buildings. What's that?
You've seen a couple. I was going to ask is like, how many have you seen? Cause literally this is the first Zaha building I've ever been inside.
Oh yeah.
And this is 2018. That says like a lot. I mean, there's only one in the US, that I'm aware of, and that's in Cincinnati. There's two. Where's the other one?
There's a gallery at Michigan State University.
Oh, okay.
Remember that? There was a competition.
Now I need to look it
up. It's the Eli Broad gallery.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. I was going to get to that because actually that's the only one I've been inside.
Okay.
And then we saw one on the High Line when we were at the New York conference.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So
there's that new building on the High Line.
That's correct. So that would have been first. So that was the first one I've seen. Whenever he didn't get inside that one, I did get inside this one. So there's two Zaha buildings I've seen. Thank you. All in 2018. Crazy.
So you went after the conference then?
Yeah.
It was in like June. So you went later.
Yeah, end of June.
Oh, that's right. I remember we talked about that. You had this awesome month of basically conference, then hang out, then go fly off to London and do all that.
Conference in New York, you know, amazing experience and award, and go to London with my daughter on her first overseas trip. Because is Canada overseas? Across the ocean trip. and then, you know, so
it's only been a few weeks. You've forgotten all of your geography.
Geography's thrown out the window because I can't leave the house. So
it's just past your bedroom window.
I think I can see Russia from my backyard.
This is how you got to do it to stay sane. Stay sane. So, interestingly, if you're not familiar with Michigan State's campus there,
Michigan State is where?
In East Lansing, Michigan.
Okay.
So just east of the Capitol. Capitol is in Lansing, then East Lansing.
Yeah. You say that like everybody's got their Michigan geography just on point.
Well, if you could see me right now, I'm pointing.
Yeah, are you gesturing? Are you like, okay, so Michigan shaped like this?
Well, it's shaped like a mitten. But so East Lansing is basically a college town Michigan State's a very big campus, and it's a very old campus for the state, and it was founded as an agricultural school, so. You know, they
It's a land grant college.
It's a land grant college. Yeah. So it has a massive, massive territory. Like the boundary is humongous. I mean, you couldn't even walk across campus if you had a class on either ends and get there in, you know, 45 minutes. So a lot of people drive, but so it's got this big sprawling campus and a lot of older brick architecture, but they're also building a lot of newer buildings in their sciences studies, things like that, and some of their dormitories too, a little more modern. But the Zaha building it's about 10. How old is that building? Maybe it's more than 10 years old. No, it's probably about 10 years old. And it like many Zaha buildings, receive the love to hate kind of reactions. Because it's
That's modern. That's not going to be me though. You know, I'm just going to love it. So,
oh yeah, right. And I it was an interesting, it was a design competition that Eli Broad put on it to sort of fund he was going to fund it. And so he kind of working with Michigan State. And so he put together this short list of Morphosis, Coop Himmelblau, Stephen Hall, Zaha, and, someone else, a fifth kind of a big name architect, not Frank Gehry, but somebody in the same, in that same realm. And they all were, I assume, given a stipend to design a concept. And, at the time when the design competition was going on, I was still in California and I was following this because of the notoriety and the list of architects involved in. Kind of rooting for the Morphosis because it was like super fanboy Morphosis, you know, California at the time.
Did you dress like Tom or did you dress like Roto? Michael.
I think I dressed like a broke college graduate. Okay. I couldn't afford to dress like either of them. I think I probably would have been closer aligned to Tom's, but I did appreciate Michael Rotundi's zen-like outfits everywhere he went.
If Michael Rotundi wore orange pants, then you would be more of a Roto fanboy, I think.
Copycat. Yeah, he does. His website at least has that color, but you know, hey, maybe. You got me all off the track here. So Zaha's building is the one that gets built. Actually, no, I know the structural engineer that did the structural for it is a local, he's Ann Arbor based, architect and engineer. And so it was kind of neat to, hear some stories on that building, but it's so modern. It looks like a bunch of steel shards kind of ramming into the ground and kind of carving a little bit of a courtyard for the entry and glass and tilting walls and things like that. And I think it was it's not a very cheap building, but it was done very well. I think the details are great. I've heard certain reactions on some Zaha buildings that the detailing of panel connections and things like that is a little clunky or leaves something to be desired, but Tink disagrees.
Tink's like, don't you go shut after your mouth.
Shut your mouth.
Yeah. Shut your mouth, Kurt.
But I would say to that, you know, like if it, you know, it's an experiment in a ways, you know, you're kind of taking a leap of faith and, you know, fabricating something for the first time is going to be a challenge. But if you don't take that first step, you'll never know if it could be really done or replicated again in the future. And then we'd have no progress, right? I mean, I'm sure Julia Morgan did things that people would say, oh, no, you can't do that. We can't do that.
Right. Well, I mean, and I think Zaha's, I mean, it's, you know, there's so much of her work and, you know, and her career, you know, there's, you know, I mean, the paintings and the expression, it, you know, there's a level of anti-gravity to her work, even in the works that are built. And I think that that creative exploration, of material and detail and form, you know, I pulled up the Morgan State project, our Michigan State, project, and, you know, was, you know, looking at it and as you're describing it, and yeah, the facets, you know, of the form and the interplay of light is really quite amazing. And I'm glad to hear that you thought that the details were executed well when you saw them in person. Cause I mean, from the images I can see, it really does, need that, but at the same time, it really looks indicative of some of her kind of expressive ideas. You know, where you're, you know, the world feels a little bit warped, and I liked that sort of idea of movement is just sort of captured in stasis, you know, in her projects, you know, and I think that the thing about the one in London that I got to see and go inside is it's probably one of her smaller works. And it's really hard to draw a white building, you know, with just, you know, pen and ink, and no color and really kind of capture the form. And I think what it ends up kind of highlighting is light and shadow as a material. And I think that's why, you know, you were talking about how I cross-hatched and stippled and I think that those things were certainly, so basically because we're all at home right now, apparently this is the time of night, that everybody is walking by the house. So I'm just hoping that they're all 6 feet apart. I'm imagining that's what Tink's really worried about.
That's right.
You're social not 6 feet police. Apart. Distance. but, when am I going for my walk? But yeah, I think that the work in Hyde Park was pretty amazing. And so that was just drawn from a photo that I had actually taken, when we were on that trip.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm glad. Yeah. One day when you come visit Michigan, when you're released from the stay at home,
yeah,
then we'll have to go down to East Lansing. Cause the fun part about walking around is actually walking around the building. Cause she did a nice job too of the paving outside the building and how and where benches occur. Cause it's on the edge of the campus. So it's still connected. It's near the art school. And so it's within a lot of walking distance to campus buildings, but still stands alone. But the paving patterns kind of weave themselves into the rest of the campus, pathways and things like that. And then, you know, benches and the entrance, you know, is in a kind of a little tucked away spot. So it's, you kind of, if you don't know where you're going, you might actually walk around the entire thing before you figure out which one is the front door, which is, it's not that confusing, but it is kind of it has this really interesting vantage point from all four sides.
Well, and I think a building like that, I mean, you know, it's especially in sort of campus architecture. We've talked about that before, is that, you know, some buildings really need to have four sides that, and I think, you know, something like this and, something in her work, I think I'm able to sort of picture that scene a little bit. So yeah, Michigan, here I come. Not yet, but soon. Hopefully soon.
The Serpentine gallery edition that she did, though, is what is the material that the white material Is it like an acrylic or something, or is it metal?
It's metal. Yeah.
So shiny.
Yeah, it's got like a and what's hard to render in the image, but you can see it's sort of that the white portion has become kind of a cafe piece. They've mm-hmm. apparently it wasn't a cafe when it originally was designed, and sort of has morphed a little bit programmatically. But there's some skylight perforations that have an amorphous form, and you can get a sense of two of those underneath this fold that's sort of created. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be the episode where Tink gets first billing. I think that's what she's saying. I'm patient all these times, and now it's my show. Because you were talking
about that's all good. Yeah, it's all. I mean, hey, I'm sure our listeners are managing their own pets and humans as we all are staying home. Just keeping that social. I think she's also reminding you, remember before we started recording, we talked about an appropriate social distance from our microphones. Sure that
yes.
we don't have sound issues.
Sound issues. Yep.
So she's working for me now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You guys had a chat. Yep. Got it. Yep.
No, the I mean I'm looking at some other pictures of the gallery, but I could see in the sketch, you know, the reflections and then the sort of seeing through the glass too and into these sort of scoops of light. In the undulating roof plane that it is, and it's, you know, just barely touching the ground, which I stumbled across one of the structural framing, like a photograph before they put the skin on the building, and it's a really nice, cool steel armature that they designed for this. It's one of those points where you kind of merge the disciplines of structural and architectural into the solution of the building, right? You don't have this great shape and then you have a structural engineer just plow columns like right through the whole. Not that that's ever happened to anyone.
I agree with you. Those scoops are pretty amazing. And, you know, originally it was sort of conceived more as a cafe event space, and now it's pretty exclusively a cafe. But I still think it really works as this kind of open form that the scoops really become kind of a structural element, but at the same time a way to kind of anchor the ceiling plane to the space itself, and how it sort of dips down at the edge. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, well-executed, small intervention, in a historical context, which I can really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially, yeah, the sensitivity to connecting to the existing building, which is, yeah, it is a great example for anyone who's concerned about historical preservation, I would say. In a modern world.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everybody, you know, wants to have that beautiful brick wall, like, on the inside of their building. And, the reason why there's a beautiful brick wall on the inside of this building is that that brick was the exterior brick. And, you know, most of the brick that you see that's on an interior of a building, most of that was plastered. In historical context, on the interior, because the plaster made it a finished space, and you were using brick that was not necessarily the best face brick that you would use on the exterior of a building, because that was mm-hmm. intended to be seen. Mm-hmm. So the brick that often gets exposed in those historical lofts or And somebody peels the plaster off and thinks it's going to be great. Then they find out that all that brick on the inside isn't as pretty as they thought it was going to be. And it also, the brick dust is pretty annoying, especially in like restaurant or retail spaces. But yeah, when you go into a more industrial building, a lot of those never had the plaster on the inside. So that brick on the interior, had a very, very different appearance. And so if, you know, go into a warehouse that's been converted into lofts, the brick there, it's a different aesthetic because it always was that way. It never was covered up.
Right.
But there's my historical diatribe for a moment, but with Saha's work here, I think it's you're absolutely right in saying, you know, this is a great example of, you know, modern meets old, in a beautiful blending. I'm also a big fan, so my fanboy moment.
Yeah. And not to forget that I know Zaha did win the Pritzker. I don't know if she won an AIA gold medal though.
AIA gold medal, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But Pritzker, most definitely. So she got the Nobel Prize. So
that's right. So on that note, we should probably wrap it up for today.
Thanks, Kurt. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I did too. And stay safe. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. We both hope that you enjoyed this episode of Coffee Sketch Podcast. Our theme music is provided by my brother, who goes by at Cold Fashion on Instagram and Twitter. Our podcast is hosted at coffeesketch.buzzsprout.com. Find more show notes and information from this episode. And finally, if you like what you heard, please rate us on iTunes and share us with your friends. Thank you.